Hicks v. Forest Preserve District, Appeal Number 11-1124. Ready, Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
Good morning.
Morning.
The fatal deficiency in plaintiff's case, Your Honors, is the complete absence of any evidence of causation in this case. In this case, the plaintiff alleges that the Forest Preserve District retaliated against him by demoting him in September of 2006 as a result of his participation in a co-worker's discrimination investigation 22 months prior in November of 2006. Because there is no evidence of a causal connection between these two events, Your Honors, we request that the jury verdict in Mr. Hicks' favor be reversed. Now, the Forest Preserve District hired Mr. Hicks on September 1st, 2006, as a maintenance mechanic in the in its garage, and on the same day, it also hired Geronimo Hernandez.
And we're pretty familiar with the facts, Mr. Thompson, so can we just get to this issue of the jury instruction and you know, the identification of the demotion, which is one of
the central issue in terms of causation, Your Honors, is the fact that the causation testimony was that of Mr. Joseph Hrushka, and the his testimony, according to the plaintiff, was that what he alleged was testified was that Hrushka testified that Thompson, angered by Hicks' participation in Hernandez's discrimination investigation, ordered Hrushka to document the action of Hicks. And that's essential. That is the crux of the argument that the plaintiff makes, that Mr. Hrushka gave direct testimony that Tom Thompson, because of his hostility to Mr. Hicks, angered by Hicks' participation in Hernandez's discrimination investigation, ordered Hrushka to document the actions of Hicks. The problem is, no such testimony exists in the record, Your Honor. That is critical. There is nothing in the testimony of Mr. Hrushka, not one word, that relates to Hicks' participation in Hernandez's discrimination investigation. And when you look at the pages that they cite, and what is curious is on this central point, they don't cite a particular page, they don't quote Mr. Hrushka, they cite to four different pages. But the only thing that Hrushka testified to was that Tom Thompson told him that there were a couple of employees who were troublemakers who had filed charges against him, Tom Thompson, and they needed to be gotten rid of. That is not the lawsuit that Mr. Hicks brought in this case. The judge below and all the parties agree that the only lawsuit that Mr. Hicks has brought in this case is a lawsuit that he is retaliated against because of his involvement in his co-worker's discrimination lawsuit. He did not bring a claim in this lawsuit that he is retaliated against because of his own complaint. Therefore, Mr. Hrushka's testimony, which is only concerning his own complaint, offers no evidence, direct or otherwise, concerning the motivation for involvement in the co-worker's complaint. So what we have is Mr. Hrushka giving testimony concerning a cause of action that Mr. Hicks did not bring, which is that Tom Thompson was retaliating against him for bringing a charge. And Mr. Hrushka did not give any testimony concerning the claim that Mr. Hicks did bring, which is that the district was retaliating against him for his involvement in Hernandez's investigation. And we cite in our brief, Your Honors, a number of cases in which this court has recognize the self-evident proposition that if you bring a claim alleging discrimination or retaliation on one basis, you cannot prove it by offering evidence of discrimination or retaliation on some other basis. And that is what the plaintiff is attempting to do here.
Were there different claims? Was there something separate against Thompson?
No, Your Honor. Thompson is identified as the perpetrator, as the individual employee with retaliatory motivation. So that the claim is simply against the district, but it has identified Tom Thompson as the employee who had the retaliatory motivation against Mr. Hicks. And so the claim in this lawsuit and the complaint is simply that Tom Thompson retaliated against Mr. Hicks because of Hicks' involvement in Hernandez's discrimination claim back in November of 2006.
Well, that's the claim.
Yes.
And what's the difference between the one that claim and the one that you say?
Yes. The key difference is this, Your Honor. The only evidence that Mr. Hruszka gave was that Tom Thompson had a retaliatory motivation against Mr. Hicks because of Mr. Hicks' own claim of discrimination against Tom Thompson. That is not in this complaint. Mr. Hicks does not allege in the complaint, not in the final pretrial order or anywhere else, that he personally filed a charge and was retaliated against because he filed a charge. And at the final pretrial conference stage, Judge Kaur raised the question of whether or not the retaliation charge should include both. He could have been retaliated against because he filed his own charge, or he could have been retaliated against because he participated in his co-worker's charge. When Judge Kaur looked at the complaint, he saw, no, that's not correct, because the plaintiff never alleged that he was retaliated against because he filed his own charge. And the point simply is that the Hruszka testimony, which is the linchpin of the argument by the plaintiff of direct evidence, only goes to the issue of whether or not Mr. Thompson was retaliating against Hicks for filing his own charge. That is not the lawsuit that is before you, Your Honors. The only lawsuit before you is that Mr. Hicks was retaliated against by the district through Tom Thompson for his participation in the discrimination claim of a third party, Mr. Geronimo Hernandez. And there is no evidence. The word investigation does not appear in the testimony of Mr. Joseph Hruszka. So it is a false statement to say that Mr. Hruszka testified that Mr. Thompson was angry because of Mr. Hicks' involvement in the Hernandez investigation. That is not the testimony, and that is a misrepresentation of the evidence. Other than this testimony of Mr. Hruszka, the only evidence that the plaintiff rely on is what they call a plethora of disciplinary action forms that Mr. Thompson subjected Mr. Hicks to. And the problem there, again, the causation issue is one of proximity, temporal proximity, or actually the lack thereof. Mr. Hicks was involved in the Hernandez investigation November 2006. The first disciplinary action form that the plaintiff says related to this plan to get this man demoted was in June of 2008, 19 months later. They identify the plaintiff in the plaintiff's briefs identify five disciplinary action forms that they say were the basis for the plaintiff being discharged. And the first one was the Defendant's Exhibit Number 9. It was in June of 2008. So we have a temporal disconnect of 19 months. And nowhere does the plaintiff offer any explanation as to how there would be causal relationship or inference of causation from protected activity that occurred in November of 2006 and disciplinary action forms that are administered in June of 2007. And the only thing they say is there's a bright line rule. And that's true, but this court has identified many instances of periods of time much shorter than 19 months. In fact, the Leonard case, this court has stated that the six-month period, a distance between the protected activity and the alleged adverse employment action of even 6 months is too long to support an inference of retaliation or discrimination.
What about all those other disciplinary citations or whatever they called them? It said something like 28.
Well, there were a grand total of 9 that were introduced in this case, Your Honor. The first one was introduced. The first one occurred in December of 2006, which is 1 month after the involvement. Right. And then the next one after that by Mr. Thompson was entered in March of 2008, a gap of 13, 14, 15 months. But specifically in plaintiff's brief, they say that the disciplinary action forms that I'm here at page 16 and 17, they identify the specific, they talk about all these disciplinary action forms, but they identify the specific ones that they say led to his demotion, and they say these are the five which are Defendant's Exhibits 9 through 13. And the first of those is in June of 2008. And there is no explanation of how you can have a inference of discrimination or inference of retaliation for protected activity that occurs that is separated by 19 months. And the other point that has been made, of course, is that this court has said many times that disciplinary action forms are not in and of themselves adverse employment actions. So actually, the adverse employment action was ultimately the demotion. That demotion occurred in September of 2008.
But don't those things culminate in the disciplinary hearing that was set? There were the nine of them, and the last couple triggered the setting of the hearing. And then shortly prior to the hearing, the deal is worked out where he gets the demotion.
The plaintiff's position in their brief is that the last five are the ones that culminated in the in the meeting that resulted in Mr. Hicks being demoted. That's their position in their brief, to these last five. And the problem, among others, is that the first of those five is 19 months after the action. So that's the issue. And so we have a 19-month gap between the protected activity and even the first disciplinary action form. So the protected activity is in November of 2006. The disciplinary action form that they identified as culminating in the termination is June of 2008. There were no disciplinary action forms signed by Tom Thompson in the whole calendar year of 2007. So you go from December of 2006, the one, and you jump the entire year of 2007 and go to what they're saying is June of 2008, and they're suggesting that there's some inference of causation, and there's no evidence of that. In fact, the only evidence that they say is, yeah, but here we have the direct evidence from Hrushka. And again, that direct evidence of Hrushka does not go to the specific cause of action that this plaintiff has raised.
So you say with Hrushka, whatever you call it, his testimony, you say, does not reference at all the one 19-month earlier. It's only something that was confined to something about Thompson personally?
Hrushka was hired in May of 2008.
He was just there 3 months.
He was only there for 3 months, and his start date was May of 2008. And we're talking about protected activity that occurred in November 2006. So we've got a huge gap there. But then Hrushka's testimony does not relate to the claim that's made in this complaint. Hrushka's testimony does not relate to Hicks' involvement in Hernandez's investigation. That's the problem. Hrushka's testimony only relates to Hicks' own complaint. And so that the his testimony does not support an inference that the district retaliated against Mr. Hicks because of Hicks' involvement in Hernandez's complaint.
Okay, so Hicks is complaining now about the way Thompson's treating him.
Yes.
And Hrushka is testifying about his, whoever said we got to get rid of Hicks.
Yes.
Because of whatever the conflict between him and Thompson, as opposed to Hernandez.
That's essentially correct. Hrushka's testimony is that Thompson told us we got to get rid of Hicks because Hicks filed complaints against me. Mm-hmm. And that's not the lawsuit that Hicks has brought. Mm-hmm. Hicks has brought the lawsuit saying that Thompson, the district, is trying to get rid of me because of my involvement in Hernandez's discrimination claim. There's zero evidence on that point, and without that, there's no direct evidence of causation. The disciplinary action forms by themselves do not provide that. And therefore, Your Honor, we believe that this matter should be remanded to the district court for entry of judgment on behalf of the district. Are there any other questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Thompson. You will have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Delaney.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I struggle with what counsel refers to as the central issue in this case, because upon review of the issues before the Court, the aspect of direct evidence, causation, or temporal proximity is not an issue before this Court right now. To the contrary, if the Court reviews the JNOV motion, which was filed and which is the subject of this appeal, nowhere in that motion is the name Herska even mentioned. So the issue that counsel is attempting to call the central issue is not one of the four issues on appeal. As the court noted correctly, the jury instruction issue is one of the issues, but whether or not Herska provided direct evidence is not an issue before the court in this appeal. Notwithstanding such, counsel misconstrues the testimony. Mr. Herska testified as to both charges filed by Mr. Hernandez and Mr. Hicks. He testified as to more discrimination than the core discrimination at the complaint at issue. In the complaint at bar, Mr. Hicks filed and alleged that he was retaliated against for participating in the investigation filed by Mr. Hernandez. And it is true that Mr. Herska testified as to more than one charge being filed, but it is not true that he did not testify as to Mr. Hernandez's charge. He uses the name Geronimo Hernandez and makes that direct statement. In addition, a supervisor above Mr. Herska, Leroy Taylor, later on in the trial, testifies as to the investigation that was concluded and testifies that Mr. Hicks cooperated and was involved in the investigation that Mr. Hernandez had filed against Mr. Thompson. So the central issue that he calls the central issue is that apparently there was such a vast overabundance of discriminatory conduct by Mr. Thompson that that should obscure the direct evidence as to retaliatory conduct and discriminatory animus. Now, the fact that it's not in the JNOV motion and it's not an issue outlined in the appeal, I'll defer to the court as to determine whether that is ambush, forfeiture, or waiver.
Well, I think he's just getting to this the forest preserves argument that they're entitled to a judgment as a matter of law and the claim of retaliation and the subsection that deals with the causal connection. I mean, I think that's where he was focusing.
I appreciate that, but I think that... I'm sorry?
That is in the brief.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Now, the issue then, going to the issues before the court, a reasonable jury could find there was adverse employment action. There were many adverse employment actions, most notably the demotion at issue in this case. Mr. Hicks did not voluntarily accept the demotion. He had no choice. He was called to a meeting without being told what it was. When he arrived at the meeting, there was a firing squad of eight upper management people. There was HR, there was legal counsel, there were the supervisor's supervisor. And at that meeting, he was told he had to pick between adverse action A or B. Adverse action A was termination, the threat of termination. The word termination was used. Adverse action B was the demotion. And he had to choose quickly. In fact, they wanted him to choose immediately, but at the end of this ambush meeting where the firing squad forced this choice upon him, he was given 24 hours. He testified at trial. He did not make that choice voluntarily. He made that choice because he was forced to. Now, the jury heard plenty of evidence. We had a week-long trial. There were 11 witnesses, 23 exhibits, an exhaustive direct and cross-examination regarding the nine disciplinary action forms. Now, counsel has crafted a temporal proximity argument suggesting there's a nine-month lapse. That simply doesn't withstand scrutiny. First, the protected activity was engaged in November 2006. The first disciplinary action form was issued less than 1 month later, in December 2006. Thereafter, between December 2006 and June 2008, there were a series of nine disciplinary action forms issued. Now, the disciplinary action forms that counsel refers to, he glosses over the fact that in the disciplinary action forms, it relates back to the previous ones as well. So he skips ahead to the last disciplinary action form, which relates back to all the other ones. But the key issue between causation and temporal proximity here is that each and every one of the disciplinary action forms was originated by Tom Thompson. He was the source of the information. He was the person who initiated them. He was the one with discriminatory animus against Mr. Hicks, and he was the sole conclusion maker on the content of the disciplinary actions form. The briefs and counsel suggest that Mr. Wagner somehow did this, but at trial it was established that Mr. Wagner is not a mechanic. Mr. Wagner was not trained to make any conclusions as to Hicks' work ability, and that Mr. Wagner relied upon Mr. Thompson for the three disciplinary action forms he signed. And if you look at the disciplinary action forms, you'll see on the face of them that he refers to Mr. Thompson said X, Mr. Thompson concluded Y. This is the fact before the court. Then in addition, there's one other one that was evidently signed, a disciplinary action form, by Len Dufkus. Again, they suggest that this is some intervening actor, but yet again, if you look at the face of that disciplinary action form, it is prepared by Tom Thompson. So every disciplinary action form leads directly back to Tom Thompson. There was direct evidence of a discriminatory animus and retaliatory conduct, and the district court made clear when they denied the motion for a directed verdict at trial, there was ample evidence of retaliatory conduct. Now, this issue was raised previously in summary judgment, and I think Judge Kaur brilliantly articulated it when he said in his order that the defense would have you believe that revenge is a dish that cannot be served cold, but that simply is not the law. So, going on to the other issues in the case, there is the question of the cat's paw theory. And does it apply in this case? And we would put forth unequivocally it does. Staub is the case that controls. The Supreme Court has made it very clear. Tom Thompson was a supervisor with retaliatory animus. There was evidence of that. Thompson was not the decision maker who pulled the trigger, but the evidence elicited at trial showed that none of the decision makers that pulled the trigger that were at this ambush meeting where the demotion occurred independently investigated. They testified they all relied upon the disciplinary action forms in convening this meeting and forcing this decision upon Mr. Hicks. They testified that they relied on Thompson's input, and the causation goes to, as Staub made clear, whether it's a singular input or a influence input. Under both analysis, it is Tom Thompson who is the driving fact and the originating source of the information found in each and every disciplinary action form that is tendered to the jury at evidence. So there is absolutely a causal connection because there are no disciplinary action forms prior to the protected activity, and it is the series of disciplinary action forms that led to that meeting where he was forced to choose between the road to termination or a demotion. Without the disciplinary action forms, no human resources person is ever looking at Mr. Hicks. No manager is looking. No legal counsel is brought in. They were all brought in based upon the disciplinary action forms created, generated, and marshaled through the channels by Thompson. So they ultimately pulled the trigger, but as Staub made clear, isolation of the decision maker does not shield the employer from liability. The issue as to the jury instruction, Your Honors, the law is very clear. It is, does it accurately state the law? It unequivocally does. The case law in the Seventh Circuit makes it clear that it doesn't have to be an idealized perfect set. It has to accurately state the Seventh Circuit law. In this case, it does accurately state the Seventh Circuit law. And in addition, there's no evidence of confusion or being misled. There is no evidence of prejudice in the brief whatsoever. So I think that the case law on this issue is rather clear-cut.
How can we be sure on this jury instruction, the way it was structured, that the jury didn't base its decision on things other than the demotion, like, you know, not being able to order his own parts or not being allowed in the office?
Well, those issues were the narrative as to what led up. The factual inquiry in the week-long trial as to the disciplinary action forms was this a put-up job? Were these disciplinary action forms a sham and pretextual, or was there merit behind them? And there was extensive testimony by Mr. Hicks and Mr. Thompson, and it all went to the jury as to their credibility. And those factors went to the reality of the factors in the disciplinary action form.
Well, wouldn't it have been clear to identify the demotion and the instruction as the action at issue?
Well, as Judge Kaur said in the trial and in his ruling on this, adverse action is adverse action. There was a multitude of adverse actions in this case. That is correct. But the demotion was clearly the elephant in the living room. Mr. Hicks, the plaintiff, was demoted from a mechanic skilled labor position to a serviceman to manual labor position. He was transferred from working in a garage to a janitor job, picking up trash and snow, and he lost one-third of his pay cut. None of those issues are contested. Those are all facts and evidence submitted to the jury. So the issues, the narrative as to the facts and circumstances behind the work environment and what was going on and what led to these allegations in the disciplinary action forms, those issues were narrative and the story as to what occurred in this garage. And those issues were fully crossed, and the credibility of the testimonial witnesses was fully presented at trial. And as I said, there was a week-long trial here, so this issue was vetted, and it was vetted extensively.
I just don't understand why the Seventh Circuit instruction wasn't used, because then it would be clear this wouldn't even be an issue.
Well, Your Honor, as the case law makes very clear, it is a model jury instruction, and it is at the discretion of the trial court to craft the jury instruction based on the facts of the matter as the trial court deems appropriate. It is correct that the Seventh Circuit jury instruction could have been used, but the fact that Judge Court chose not to use the Seventh jury instruction doesn't prejudice the jury instruction. It's simply a matter of, did he accurately state Seventh Circuit law? And, Your Honor, the courts have said in the employment cases, they are retaliation standard is different. Discrimination, age discrimination, political hiring, a lot of the other cases the counsel's relying on, it's a different standard than employment. It is a complex, highly circumstantial, highly fact-based, highly evidence-based inquiry at trial. So there is a higher standard, and the discretion of the circuit court to craft the appropriate jury instruction is to use the model rules available and the rules available as to the potential jury instructions that could be out there. And one of the factors that obviously I would suggest influenced Judge Kaur is the Supreme Court had a summary, a case pending. The Staub case was in the Supreme Court at this time. So there were a lot of fluidity into employment law at the time. So Judge Kaur took extensive time to craft the appropriate jury instruction, but the key inquiry remains. He did not misstate the law. He lacked a certain specificity, but he could have included the word demotion. He could have included the word pay cut. He could have included the word transfer and reassignment. He could have included the word mechanic position to janitorial position.
Yeah, but other than the demotion and all those things you recite, what other adverse action was there?
What other adverse action?
What you just recited was one activity. Yeah, he got a pay cut. He got a different location. He was demoted.
Right. Correct. What,
is there another adverse action, or could there be other adverse action when the instruction refers to adverse action?
Well, as I understand counsel's argument, he's trying to say that because there was a series of conduct and or retaliatory action and or adverse action, some of them may not reach the level of materially adverse. So there was a narrative. There was a story.
There's only one. There's only one, and that's the demotion.
Correct. And as Judge Kaur said, an adverse action is an adverse action. So counsel suggesting that because there are other things the jury theoretically, and again, he's purely speculating here, he's saying because there are other things the jury could have considered adverse, perhaps maybe they ignored the elephant in the living room of demotion and the pay cut and the reassignment, and they relied on something else. But that simply doesn't hold water. And in counsel's own brief, Your Honor, he contradicts himself and that he says it is impossible to identify the basis, and then therefore he suggests that since it's impossible to identify the basis of the jury finding, that we should speculate that it could have been a singular instance, not the elephant in the living room, the materially adverse demotion, and these factors that were addressed at summary judgment, and there was extensive work on in the pretrial conference. And that is a speculative argument. The issue before the court is, could a reasonable jury have found for this plaintiff? Was there legally sufficient basis? And I would submit, Judge, that the adverse action was presented in multitude of forms. It was presented in the form of a demotion. It was presented in the form of a pay cut. It was presented in the form of being removed from a mechanic position to a janitorial position.
All of those add up to demotion. All of those are subsets of demotion.
And I think that's perhaps one of the issues that...
It's just, it would just have been clearer and more direct if he just said demotion. So we don't have to speculate. That's the point.
I
understand he dealt with the Ninth Circuit model instruction, but it just makes it cleaner if it's identified, because that's the only adverse action. Everything you're outlining all falls under the demotion. The pay cut, the change of location, that's all part of the demotion.
And Your Honor, I agree that you could use the demotion term as the umbrella of those factors, which are all reach the level of material adverse. But as the Knox Court said, the Seventh Circuit has made clear, it does not require an idealized set of perfect jury instructions. It requires that the statement of law be stated accurately. And this is not, there's no misstatement in this jury instruction. There is a lack of specificity, yes, but there is no material misstatement of law. So you can't impute a misstatement of law. What happens here is that there is a conjecture and there is speculation regarding, well, what if they decided to rule upon this incident on day one of the trial, not this incident on day five of the trial? And that's not the standard. The question is, was there a legally sufficient basis in the collective trial presented to the jury, and could a reasonable jury have come back with
it? Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson.
Your Honor,
two. 2 minutes.
Is that 4 minutes? Are we reserved 4 minutes?
2 minutes.
Okay. Your Honor.
How much time?
Yeah, 2 minutes. But you
right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, so you went into some of your rebuttal time. So.
All right. Your Honor, to begin with the issue of the jury instruction, counsel is correct. We had a five-day trial, and during that trial, we heard paragraphs and pages of testimony about how Mr. Hicks wasn't allowed to order his own parts. He wasn't able to work on a rack. He wasn't being allowed in the office. He had to, his bay was moved in front of the window. And the jury heard all of this and made huge deals of how what an awful person Tom Thompson was for doing all these awful things. And without it, and counsel says now it would have been clearer, we argued vigorously, and the plaintiff vigorously opposed our proposed jury instruction and simply said we're talking about the demotion. And so the problem is that we put in lots of evidence that says that the demotion was voluntary, it was not retaliatory, but the jury could just as easily have decided on a whole host of these other things. And the jury instruction, you're correct, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit jury instruction would have resolved all that. We don't know that, and it did prejudice us. It did prejudice the defendant, because without that, any of these things, any combination of these things that are minor nuisances, annoyances that do not rise to the level of adverse employment action could have been the basis. We don't know that.
Well, even though the jury instruction didn't name the demotion, didn't it say the jury needed to find that there was an action directed toward an employee which would reasonably discourage him from cooperating in the investigation of a charge of discrimination? And that's an accurate statement of the law.
That is, Your Honor. But there's nothing that helps the jury make a decision on what that is. This court has said a whole host of things do not constitute adverse employment action. For example, disciplinary action forms. They made a huge issue at trial about how many disciplinary action forms he was receiving. Those disciplinary action forms, they made a huge argument at trial about him not being allowed to bring a union representative in. Those things don't constitute adverse employment action, and the jury wasn't told, wasn't given any guidelines of what is and what isn't an adverse employment action. Now we say the only thing here is demotion. If we said that, then that's what the jury had been focused on, and we wouldn't have this issue before you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Judge.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel, both counsel, for your fine arguments and your briefs, and we will take the case under advisement and call.